Okay, so in the section before we broke for coffee there, what we've been looking at is how you go about estimating parameters. We looked at least squares as a kind of workhorse method that everyone's learned about earlier in their careers, but maybe not a lot of the details as to where least squares comes from or how you would extend it to more complicated cases. I've just exposed you in passing to some of the sort of cleverer methods that exist to optimize least squares. I've mentioned things like the gradient descent for nonlinear problems, the fact that you can tackle multivariate problems using matrix approaches, and that inverting big sparse matrices can be fraught with danger, so singular value decomposition is a good way to do that. So everything we talked about before coffee was assuming a model and then trying to determine the best fitting parameters for that model. Well, that still leaves the question, what if your model isn't any good to begin with? You can always find the best fitting parameters, but then even the best fitting ones still might be pretty lousy as a fit. So what would you do in that case? How would you determine how good your PDF model is in the first place? So that's what I'm going to look at in this section. The absolute simplest example of this is called a simple hypothesis test. And that's where you kind of basically know everything there is to know about your model, apart from just one key aspect of it that you want to test. So suppose your sample data are drawn from a normal PDF, and it's got mean mu and variance sigma squared, and you want to test that null hypothesis and see whether your data agree with it. So the way you might go about that, let's look at a specific example. If sigma squared was known, say your measured data were just 10 data points and the sum of all the data points was 47.8, I've just kind of picked a number at random, your null hypothesis might be as follows. It might be that those data came from a normal distribution and the mean of that normal was 4. You know, whatever the problem is, that might be a significant number. And if we assume that we know sigma, and moreover that sigma is 2, then sigma squared on the mean is 0.4. Now where does that come from? That comes from sigma squared being 4, 2 squared, but there's 10 observations. So when you work out the mean, it's more tightly clustered around the true mean, and therefore the variance of it is 4 divided by 10, which is 0.4. The observed sample mean is 4.78. That's 47.8 divided by 10 observations. So the question here is 4.78 close enough to 4 to be acceptable? That's what you're trying to determine. So the way that that's normally tackled, whether it be in the old-fashioned way where people would go and look up some table in a book, or these days much more commonly, you just stick the numbers into a computer. Even if it's done by computer, what's basically being done by the computer program is it's taking your data and it's turning it into a standard normal variable. A new variable Z, call it, which is X bar obs, the value that you actually got, 4.78, minus the model value, 4, divided by the sigma for that model value, which is the square root of 0.4. So that turns out to be a standard normal value of 1.233. So if you got exactly the same answer as the null hypothesis model value, then that variable Z would be 0. But it's not. The question is, how far away is it from 0? Is it too far away to allow you to accept that this was a good model? So how do you approach that? You see that if the null hypothesis is true, what you want to do is to work out a probability that sort of attaches to this number a measure of how likely it is that you would get that number, or indeed an even bigger one. So you call that probability, it's called the p-value, and this is, you know, the bread and butter of a million hypothesis tests that have been applied to physical sciences data since time immemorial. So if you think about it in terms of a picture, what you're saying is that you've got a test statistic, this thing Z, which has got a normal distribution with mean 0 and standard deviation 1, and the actual value you got was 1.233. So what you want to sort of characterise is how likely it would have been to get that value, or indeed an even bigger one. So that's represented by the area shown shaded in yellow. The p-value is the probability of getting z bigger than or equal to the observed value of z. Now we've put modulus signs on because we're equally troubled in this case by having a very large or a very small, i.e. large negative, value of z. So you can work that out, but it doesn't have an analytic solution. But there's plenty of programs around, either within MATLAB as an embedded program, or indeed there's lots of little Java applets on the web where you can stick these numbers in and work them out too. No doubt there's an app for it as well, although I haven't checked that out myself yet. So the way it works is the smaller the p-value, the less credible is the null hypothesis. The larger the p-value, the more credible is the null hypothesis. So in this case, we got a p-value of 0.216. That means to say the area under the red curve in total, all the way to minus infinity and plus infinity, is 1. That's by definition because it's a probability density function. The area in the yellow parts is 0.2176, about 22%. So that what you're saying is that, okay, for my actual data, I got a z value of 1.233, and there's a 22% chance that I could have got as big or even bigger a value if I'd repeated my experiment a large number of times. So in essence, that means the value I did get is no big deal, because it's not that unusual. Okay? If, on the other hand, the value of z I had got was 3, then the probability of getting as big or bigger would be much smaller, a much smaller p-value, which would make it less credible that the data really did come from the model you've adopted as your null hypothesis. There are variations on this. You can do it where you actually just worry about one side rather than both, and we'll see an example of that in a moment. So let's just see if any of that has made sense. Suppose you've got some one-tailed hypothesis test. Under the null hypothesis, that's if your model is correct, the test statistic ought to have a uniform distribution, all values equally likely between 0 and 1. Now what you actually got was a value of 0.8. So in that case, what would the p-value be? Would it be 0.8, 0.9, 0.2, 0.1? Yeah, not many people sure, but it is in fact 0.2. It's very unusual that you would get a case where you can work it out as easily as that, where you can just do it in your head. The reason you could in this case is because the null hypothesis, under that null hypothesis, the test statistic has a uniform distribution, and the p-value is the probability of getting as big or bigger a value of the test statistic. So we got from the real data 0.8, we could have got any value between 0.8 and 1, and there's a 20% chance of it lying in that range. So the p-value is 0.2. Again, that would be no big deal. It's not that unusual to have got the observed value that we did. If you don't assume that sigma squared is known, that's where the student's t-distribution comes in. I'm just going to skip this bit. It's all there if you ever need to consult it. But the student's t is just a generalisation of the normal distribution to deal specifically with finite sample sizes, with some quite messy algebra in the process. We get to miss a pop quiz question as well, but that's okay. So that's the kind of relatively easy example of hypothesis testing, where you're comparing things with a normal distribution and working out areas under curves. A very, very common other example of hypothesis testing is where you're doing things with a chi-squared distribution, and that builds directly on some of the ideas we talked about in the first part, just after lunch. So let's go on to that. So we're going to look at the chi-squared goodness of fit test. Now this is an example which is couched in astrophysics language, but you know, don't let that bother you. It would be equally applicable to any other area of the physical sciences too. But it so happens that because Phil Gregory's a radio astronomer, he's come up with an example along these lines. These are observations of a galaxy And the way he's measured the galaxy is to measure its flux density in the radial. So that's what's in the vertical axis. And he's done it at different times. And the null hypothesis is that the radial emission from the galaxy is constant in time. Now, it doesn't look very constant, but of course the Volga error bars. So you're attributing the variation just to like random fluctuations in the brightness of the galaxy, not intrinsic variations in its true brightness. Okay, now, well, what do you think? Do you think the null hypothesis, just, you know, by eye, it's good to sort of get a feel for that first. How many people think the data look as if the flux density is constant? How many? Yeah, a few. How many people think it doesn't look as if it's constant? How many aren't sure? It's okay to not be sure, because that's the whole point. This is why we need to measure things like chi-squares. We can't just do it by eye. It's sufficiently varying that it doesn't look totally obvious that the null hypothesis should be supported, but nor do the variations look so extreme that you can just throw it out without any further consideration. So we do our goodness of fit test. So there's a load of chat just kind of explaining what the different steps are. What it boils down to is that you've got to measure this chi-squared quantity. Now what that chi-squared is exactly the same as what it was in the earlier section when we were doing least squares fitting. The only difference is, instead of fitting a straight line to the data, well, we are fitting a straight line, but a very special straight line, a horizontal straight line. That horizontal straight line is characterised by a single number, which is the sample mean. So if you look at your data again, what we're saying, I need to stand in the chair to do this and I'm not going to take the risk, but essentially you're just fitting a single horizontal line through that data, and then you're considering the differences, the residuals, above and below. And the question you're asking is, are those residuals too big or not? Are they acceptably small or are they too big? So you calculate your chi-squared, and what you're assuming here is that you know what sigma is. So that means you've, from past experience or prior knowledge, you've got a good handle on what the size of the error bar ought to be. And then you calculate your chi-squared, and what you want to compare that with is the sampling distribution of chi-squared. That means sort of the distribution of values you might expect to get if you were to repeat these observations a large number of times. So the sampling distribution of chi-squared depends on a number that we call the degree of freedom, denoted by nu. So what you find is that for low degrees of freedom, the chi-squared distribution looks pretty much like an exponential. For high numbers of degrees of freedom, what you get is something, well, to a physicist, we might call that a Maxwellian. It's actually got a very similar form to a Maxwellian distribution from thermal physics. Or, in fact, it looks a bit like a gamma function, if you've met those. So what is the number of degrees of freedom? Well, it's related to the number of observations we make. So the more observations you have, the more degrees of freedom you have. But there's a catch, because the chi-squared distributions on the previous slide, in fact, let's just go back to them for a minute, those are the chi-squared sampling distributions you would generate if you knew what the true mean of the distribution was. Now, we don't know that. We're having to estimate it from the sample mean. So what we need to do is to reduce the number of degrees of freedom by 1 to take account of that. Now, again, that's just a kind of rule of thumb that you do, but the underlying reason for doing it is to preserve this property of unbiasedness that I mentioned this morning as well. So, back to our data. We've got our data, so there's like 15 data points, I think. Yep, that's right. And we work out our sample mean, which in turn gives us a chi-squared. So the sample mean is 7.98, you see at the top. You get a chi-squared of 26.76. There's 15 data points, but we reduced the number of degrees of freedom to 14 because we've had to use the sample mean estimate. So in a nutshell, what we need to determine is how probable it is for a chi-squared with 14 degrees of freedom that we would get an observed value as big as or bigger than 26.76. That's represented graphically by the area in the grey at the right-hand tail. And as you can see, it looks kind of small. If we work out what that is, again, you would use a computer package or something to do it. That's providing you with potential ammunition for rejecting the null hypothesis. The smaller that p-value is, the less likely it is that the null hypothesis is true and you happen to get 26.76 just by random chance. In other words, if you repeated your observations a large number of times, you would very rarely get as big a value of chi-squared. That's what would be the case if the p-value is small. How probable is it that we would measure as large or larger a value of chi-squared? So you work it out. Again, the formula is the same as before, but just the PDF is more messy this time. It turns out to be about 2%. So this time, there's only a 2% chance you would have got as big or bigger a value of chi-squared. So I think the people that rejected the null hypothesis were probably right. But in a sense, there's no absolutely right or absolutely wrong answer. And that's another one of the key messages to take away from this. Because if we look again at how Phil Gregory puts it, what precisely does the p-value mean? It means if the galaxy flux density really is constant, i.e. if the null hypothesis is true, and you repeatedly obtain sets of 15 measurements under the same conditions, only 2% of them would give chi-squared values greater than the one that we actually measured. You might well choose to interpret that as grounds for rejecting the null hypothesis. But suppose you'd built your entire career on some theory that said the flux density from this radial galaxy is constant. You might be a bit reluctant to give that up on the basis of only 2% chance. You might be looking for an even smaller p-value before you would change your mind. In other words, really, it does just come down a little bit to subjective choice. But at least what the chi-squared test does, and other tests like it, they provide objective ammunition to help inform your choice. If somebody repeats the observations, they're going to get the same chi-squared. There's nothing will change that. They might choose to interpret it differently. I've been at lots of conferences over the years where people have talked about this. They've talked about, what does a 2% p-value mean? Does it mean you would bet your house on it? Does it mean you would bet your life on it? You know, there's a little story in a slightly related context where at a conference, Andre Lindy, who's one of the godfathers of the theory of cosmological inflation, was talking about the multiverse, the fact that the universe might just be one example of an ensemble of different universes. And he got drawn into a discussion with Martin Rees and Steven Weinberg about it. And Steven Weinberg is probably the strongest advocate of the multiverse. And he, you know, got talking to the other two, and Martin Rees had said, yes, I believe in the multiverse. I believe in it so much that I'd be prepared to bet my dog's life on the existence of the multiverse. And then Lindy pitched in and said that he'd be prepared to bet the existence of his cat's life on the multiverse being true. And then Weinberg is reported to have said that he believed in it so much that he would bet the existence of both Andre Lindy's dog and Martin Rees's cat on the existence of the multiverse. So I think what you learn from that is that the amount of trust that you attach to a particular p-value depends a lot on whether it's somebody else's theory you're trying to knock down or your own theory you're trying to defend. Now that might not sound very pure and objective, but that's just the way science is. So these tools are objective and, you know, rigorous, but how they're interpreted kind of depends on the people doing the interpreting. I'll show you some further examples of that a wee bit later on. Anyhow, another, for some of the Bayesians in this world, deeper concern about all of this is a comment that Phil Gregory makes on the next page of his book. He says, at this point you may be asking yourself, why should we care about a probability involving results that we never actually obtained? What's he getting at is meaning that to interpret the p-value, you have to imagine repeating the experiment a very large number of times. Now, you didn't actually do any of those additional experiments. Therefore, what does it all really mean? Well, that, I'm afraid, is just fundamentally the issue we face if we treat probabilities in terms of this frequentist definition of the long-term relative frequency of outcomes if you repeat experiments a large number of times. Wouldn't it be nicer if we could interpret probabilities without all of that extra baggage? Well, to some extent, the Bayesian approach offers a means of doing so, and that's what I want to switch on to now. Just before I do though, let me leave you with this table, which is something again you can just consult as a reference source in the future should you need it. What you see is a whole list of different types of problem and different types of frequentist hypothesis tests that can be applied to those problems, and references to the section of numerical recipes which gives a nice little description. You'll find all of these also discussed in any of the textbooks I've mentioned, but you know, numerical recipes, it's all there for free in the web, and the bonus is you get the codes as well should you wish them. In addition, what I've put on my Super and also on my GU website is some supplementary notes on all of this stuff, just that goes into a bit more practical examples of where the test can be applied, stuff that would have been a bit boring to go through in gory detail here, but if anybody wants to look at them, then feel free to download that too, and if you've got any questions about them, then you can get back to me. Okay. But let's switch now to Bayesian. So Bayesian hypothesis testing and Bayesian parameter estimation. The thing is, within a Bayesian framework, they're really kind of the same thing. They're just different aspects of the same thing. So let's go back to a slide we had earlier. We talked about how Bayes' theorem could be written in a form that was more amenable to kind of modern scientific thinking, that the prior is in a way of expressing what you knew before, the likelihood is a way of expressing how the observations influence your knowledge, and then the posterior is what you know afterwards in the light of your observations. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to look at an example. It's a rather artificial example, but hopefully it will still be helpful to illustrate what's kind of going on here. It's an astronomical example again, but don't let the jargon deter your understanding, because in a sense it's the jargon's kind of irrelevant. It so happens that there's a particular type of galaxy called a Seyfert, and Seyferts come in type 1 or type 2. So a problem an astronomer might face is you acquire a big survey and you're trying to estimate what the proportion of galaxies which are Seyfert type 1 and the proportion which are Seyfert type 2. Well, a good way to go about that is to take a big sample and then look at the proportion in your sample and then extrapolate from that. I mean, it's kind of a bit like what people do with opinion polls in politics, for example. So how might a Bayesian tackle such a problem? Well, you want to know what fraction are type 1. An important question you might ask then is, how large a sample do you need to reliably measure this? Because you haven't got, you know, unlimited resources whereby you can observe every galaxy in the universe, every Seyfert galaxy in the universe. Okay, so first of all, just a little bit of detail as to what the model is. We're going to adopt a binomial model. Again, the details don't really matter, but just so you can see that there is a kind of theory context to this. So theta is the global fraction of Seyfert 1s. That's what we want to estimate. And then we sample a finite number of them, n, and suppose we observe r Seyfert 1s. We can work out a likelihood for those data, and then we want to take a prior, multiply it by the likelihood, and get a posterior. That's what Bayes' theorem tells us to do. And it tells us how to do it. And the proportionality, well, we don't even really need to worry about what the proportionality constant is, because we can work that out on the fly, because what we know is that the posterior has to integrate up to 1 if you integrate over all possible values of theta, because theta is the model parameter. So what do we choose as our prior? Now, that really is a good question, and it's one that I'll look at more carefully tomorrow, and as I've already suggested earlier, it's a source of a lot of argument between Bayesians and frequentists. In fact, you know, couldn't think of how best to represent that, but you know, it's been said that there's more blood in the wall as a result of this than any other topic in data analysis. The plain truth is that really, if it boils down to disagreement over your choice of prior, what a statistician will more honestly tell you is that it's time to go and get better data. But physicists and astronomers don't often like hearing that, because that all costs time and money, and maybe you've worked really hard, you might have worked a whole lifetime to get the data set you currently have. The last thing you want is some smart ass statistician telling you that you've got to go and get more. So what physicists prefer to do is just stand around arguing about what the prior ought to be instead, because that doesn't cost as much. But nonetheless, the answer really usually is that you need better data. In other words, if the posterior does depend on the prior, then that's bad. But what I'm going to demonstrate in this example is how the choice of prior becomes increasingly less important the better data you have. If the data are good enough, it shouldn't matter. So in terms of the product we had, you've got the likelihood, you've got the prior. What you want is for the likelihood to dominate. Okay? Let me show you a couple of examples just graphically of how we can think about this. Okay, so let's look at the panel on the left. I'll go around here. Suppose the likelihood is very spiky. So that's dominating the prior. If you multiply this broad flat prior, where really what you're saying is you've no idea what the parameter value is, you assign an equal probability to a very wide range. If you multiply that broad flat prior by a narrow sharp posterior likelihood, then what you'll get is a posterior which is also narrow and sharp. So it's kind of lost any memory of what the prior was. It's dominated by the likelihood. If you look at the right hand panel, then you've got the converse situation, and the one which sometimes is all too often true in physical sciences problems. You've got a narrow sharp prior due to theoretical prejudice or just plain single-mindedness or whatever on the part of the experimenter, and you've got a broad likelihood. So in other words, the experiment you carry out doesn't really bring any fresh insight to the problem at all. Multiply the two together, the posterior is still completely dominated by the prior. Okay? Now, I've called my parameter H0, not for any special reason, but I have a particular attachment to H0 because that usually represents the Hubble parameter, which is an important number in cosmology. And again, what this allows me to do is to illustrate some important points about the domination of priors. Again, although it's a specific example to cosmology, the general philosophy is, you know, a lesson we can all learn from. But I think it's worth taking this example because there's a very nice illustration from Simon Singh which is relevant to this. So forgive me for doing another astrophysics example. What the Hubble constant is, for anyone that hasn't met this before, it's a measure of the expansion rate of the universe. So what Edwin Hubble did in the 1920s was he measured distances to galaxies, he measured the speed at which they were moving away from us, he plotted one against the other, and this is what he got. It's pretty crummy, actually, really, by today's standards, but it led him to the supposition that the universe is expanding because more distant galaxies are moving away from us ever faster. This really gave birth to the whole Big Bang theory and everything, but Hubble's original data didn't convince all that many people, and that's what I want to use as my way of illustrating the importance of prior information. So if you bear with me just while I get Simon Singh to help out. Oh, actually, I think it's on the desktop. Excuse me. Yes, it is. Saves a bit of time. Now let me just turn up the volume.
I'm going to explain this in a rather unusual way, so just bear with me for a second, and hopefully it all makes sense. I'm going to play a little bit of Led Zeppelin. Here we go. So this is Stairway to Heaven. That's Stairway to Heaven by Led Zeppelin, a song I'm sure lots of you have heard lots of times before. What I'm now going to do is play that to you again, but this time I'm going to play it to you backwards, okay? It's about 15 seconds worth, and just have a listen to this and see what you make of it. Here we go.
Oh, it is my sleep.
the crucial question. Hands up if you've heard the word Satan. Okay, that's a good couple of dozen if you heard the word Satan, that's great. Now hands up if you heard the word, here's to my sweet Satan. The one who's little path who made me sad, whose power is Satan, oh he'll give you 666, there was a little tool shed where he made us suffer sad Satan. Hands up if you heard that. just me. The extraordinary thing is this. I'm going to play this to you again. And this time, you are all going to hear these words. Okay? And I have to promise you two things. First of all, I am not going to cheat. This is going to be such a shock, so surprising, that you will assume that I've cheated or manipulated the sound or treated it in some way. What I'm going to play you is exactly what you just heard. Stay away to heaven, just play backwards. I have to promise you I'm not cheating. Second thing I promise you is you will hear all of these words, okay? So here we go, stay away to heaven, backwards, exactly the way you just heard it, but this time I think that you are all going to hear all of these words. Here we go. When you play a song backwards, it's gibberish. And first time round, that's pretty much what we all agree. But then I played it to you again, and the second time round, you all heard an entire coherent paragraph about Satan in the tool shed. So how did that work? Well, what changed was the second time I showed you some words. I suggested these words to you. I implanted them in the back of your mind. In fact, more than that, I compelled you to hear them. I said, I promise you'll hear these words. And so I've given you a bias, a prejudice, an expectation. And your brain is this lovely computer that loves to find patterns, that loves to find meaning. You've had so many conversations in noisy corridors or on bad telephone lines where you've only partly heard what's said. So your brain has to make sense of that by filling in the gaps. And it does it all the time. And 99% of the time, your brain gets it right. But every so often, if you give the brain bad data, but you give it a big enough bias and a big enough expectation, your brain fills in the gap, and you end up hearing something that really isn't there. It's only there because you kind of expect to hear it's there. And that's all that happens. You heard something that wasn't there because you were kind of suggested to hear it. And that's the effect. It's incredibly powerful, but that's all it is. So what's this got to do with the Big Bang Theory? Well, scientists are only human too. And scientists have biases and expectations and prejudices. And so when scientists look at data, especially at bad data, and remember Hubble's data, Hubble was looking at the most distant objects they know, measuring tiny, tiny shifts in colour. His data was up for interpretation. So people who didn't believe in the Big Bang, and remember, nearly everybody didn't believe in the Big Bang, would interpret Hubble's data to fulfill their expectation that it still didn't prove the Big Bang. Remember, all the professors didn't believe in the Big Bang, the establishment didn't believe in the Big Bang, the textbooks didn't believe in the Big Bang, Einstein didn't believe in the Big Bang. So people would look at the data and interpret it to fill that prejudice. So they continued not to have to believe in the Big Bang.
Okay, so as you can see, the perils of using data which is poor and dominated by a prior. So although Simon Singh isn't using the same Bayesian language and talking about priors and likelihoods, it's really the same point that he's making. So let me go on from that then to go back to my toy model and try to demonstrate to you that provided your data are good enough, your choice of prior or your prejudice, if you use Simon Singh's language, really doesn't matter. But when your data aren't so good, it matters a lot. So what this slide covers is how I go about generating some fake data. A lot of the progress we've made in the last few decades in data analysis is because, as I mentioned this morning, we've got the means now to do a lot of it on computer, and that means that we can actually generate fake data sets. And that's potentially pretty useful because you know what the parameters really are and you can check that your methods recover the right values. So we're going to do something like that. So this is just a little algorithm that lets you do that, and indeed I'll return to that in section 6. So our toy model problem is one where we're actually going to take theta to be 0.25. So that's assuming that 1/4 of all Seyferts are Seyfert 1 galaxies. And then we're going to generate some fake data. And we're going to consider two very different sorts of prior. So one prior is a flat prior. That's where all values of theta between 0 and 1 are equally likely. That's the red one, horizontal line. And then the green prior is a Gaussian, a normal distribution. It's peaked at 0.5, so we're kind of hedging our bets and saying we expect equal amounts of Seyfert 1s and Seyfert 2s. But we're not sure that that's going to be the case, so what we do is we spread our bet a bit and we allow for theta to be clustered around 0.5. So those are the two priors. And after observing zero galaxies, those are the two posteriors, because we haven't actually got any data, so our data is still determined solely, or our state of knowledge is determined solely by our prior. After observing one galaxy, which in this mock data that I've generated happened to be a Seyfert 1, look at what's happened to the flat prior. It's now turned into a posterior, which is peaked at theta equals 1. Now, theta is the proportion of our data set, which is Seyfert 1s. We've only got one data point, and it's a Seyfert 1. So we're now interpreting the probability for theta as very strongly peaked at a value of 1. The green distribution has been shifted ever so slightly, but not nearly so much, because it had a much stronger prior attraction towards a lower value of theta. Okay, so we just flip between. You can see the green one has shifted a little, but the red posterior has changed quite a lot. Then we observe another galaxy, and this time it's another Seyfert 1. So that reinforces the prior knowledge coming from the red priors, which is now sort of biased even more strongly in favour of a high value of theta, which would mean lots of Seyfert 1s. The green distribution has again shifted ever so slightly further. You can see that it's just edging towards the right, but not quite so much, because it's got a different prior assumption that's pulling it back. Then after three galaxies, Seyfert 2 comes along, so the posterior that started with the flat prior is now pulled a bit back towards lower values of theta, and indeed so too is the green. You can see that it's moving back to the left, and so it goes on. This particular realization of mock data, the next one I sample is a Seyfert 2, and so it goes on. So if you look back comparing from the 4 to the 0, in the 4 case, you've got 2 Seyfert 1s and 2 Seyfert 2s, so the distribution with the green prior is very similar to the posterior. It's just a little bit narrower. So in fact, the green prior that was centred on a value of a half of them being Seyfert 1s, half of them being Seyfert 2s, that seems to be quite strongly supported by the data, because we've got 2 Seyfert 1s, 2 Seyfert 2s, and therefore the posterior just pulls that in a little bit. So it goes on. Let me just zip through a little bit. You can see, you know, there is a consistent picture that evolves in the manner you would expect, but let me cut to the chase. If we go up to, say, 100 galaxies, or 200, then what you can see is that it's becoming much, much less sensitive to the choice of prior. And that's kind of what you'd expect. It's good news. It tells you that provided you have a big enough sample, then your choice of prior doesn't really matter. And moreover, it tells you by how much it doesn't matter as a function of the size of your sample. So it's very well suited to deal with finite sample sizes without having to invoke this idea of an infinite ensemble of data sets that we didn't actually observe. If you've got as many as 500, then they're really very close to overlapping. If you've got 1,000, they're virtually indistinguishable. Now, of course, depending on your problem, the size of sample you need before you lose the sensitivity to the prior might change. In some cases, maybe you only need 10 or 12 data points before the prior is irrelevant. It just depends on how good your data are. But the key message is that you can work these things out. And moreover, you can even really work them out in advance. Provided you know what data you expect to get, you can work out what posterior you expect to get and how tightly constrained the parameters will be. So like I said this morning, all of this argues for, in some ways, the most important part of data analysis being the analysis you do before you've even got any data, just by generating fake data and making predictions as to how your real data will perform. What do we learn from all of this? As our data improve, the posterior PDF narrows and it becomes less sensitive to the choice of prior. The posterior provides us with a way of conveying our evolving degree of belief about different values of the parameter theta in the light of our data. So you've actually got a curve that tells you something about theta. If you want to just contract that and compress it into a single number, well, what you could do is just take the mean of that curve or the median or the mode, and you can use the variance of the curve to give you an error. Although increasingly people are figuring, well, why should I bother throwing away that information? Wouldn't it be better just to actually retain the whole shape of the curve? And indeed you'll often see in many of the sort of key papers in my field that results will be presented where people don't just quote means and variances, they actually show posterior distributions for parameters. And even if you don't want to show the whole distribution, another way you can characterize it is by saying, okay, what's the kind of limits of the distribution? What are the values that encompass, say, 90% of it, throwing away 5% at one end and 5% at the other? This is what you would call a credible region. And it's the equivalent for a Bayesian of a confidence region as interpreted by a frequentist. Now, this is quite a subtle thing and I think is worth exploring slightly further. Actually, in a Bayesian framework, I think it's fairly straightforward. Well, okay, I would say that, but it really is just like what I've got in the diagram here. You calculate a posterior and you say, okay, I want to identify, let's, in this case, I've made it 95%. So I've identified 2.5% at one end, 2.5% at the other. What I'm really saying is that I'm 95% sure, I have a 95% degree of belief that the parameter theta lies between theta 1 and theta 2. That's how a Bayesian would interpret a credible region. Many of you in your own fields might have seen examples, if it's a field that's beginning to use Bayesian methods, you might have seen examples where parameters are quoted in papers and they give an asymmetric error bar, like, you know, plus 2, minus 3.5 or something like that. And that's probably been calculated along these lines by getting a posterior and then working out the values that correspond to the tails at either end of the posterior. It's only if the posterior is symmetric around the maximum value or the mean that you'll wind up with the error bar being equal on either side. Now, how's about a frequentist confidence interval? So I'll spend just a few minutes on this. I'll try not to get bogged down in it. But confidence intervals are a tricky thing, and I do encourage anyone that's, you know, interested in exploring this further to go have a look at Gregory or have a look at other source material that tries to get to grips with this, because it's quite a tricky thing. There's lots and lots of physicists out there, you know, people whom I respect, usually they're much smarter than I am in many respects to do with theory and whatever, but they just can't seem to get their head around this idea of what a confidence interval means. So let me see if I can help you do that. We go back to the example we had before, or something very similar to it, which is just a sample of 10 values drawn from a Gaussian, a normal distribution, with some mean and some sigma squared. Let's suppose that we don't know what mu is, but we know that sigma is equal to 1. So x bar is our sample mean, and that's got standard deviation sigma divided by root 10 from the argument that we talked about before. So that's 0.32 roughly. So we can make a statement along these lines. We can say that the probability that mu is less than 0.32, you can read it for yourself. At this late stage in the day, I'll probably only read it wrong if I try and read it off the board. Mu minus 0.32 is less than x bar, which is less than mu plus 0.32. We can say that that probability is 0.68. But there's a very subtle feature to this, which is very easy to miss. First of all, the relatively easy part. What you're saying is that there's a 0.68 probability of the sample mean lying in the unshaded region. And the way I've arrived at that is that I've turned the sample mean x, that random variable, into our scaled one z that we used before, which is normal with mean 0 and standard deviation 1. And there's a 68% of the area under the normal curve, the standard normal, lies between minus 1 and plus 1. So that's where we get this so-called 68 or 1 sigma confidence interval from. But here's the subtle part. One can rearrange this expression, that probability there, into the following. We can see the probability that x bar minus 0.32 is less than mu, which is less than x bar plus 0.32, is 0.68. So the subtlety is that if we then go and make an observation, we go and measure a sample mean, say we get 5.4, it's very tempting indeed to just plug 5.4 into this expression and deduce from that that the probability is 0.68, that mu lies between 5.08 and 5.72. Now, see, this is very, very subtle. It took me a long time as a grad student to get my head around this. Can we simply write that? Well, the plain answer is no. And the reason why is really the main thing I want to get you thinking about. First of all, here's a pop quiz question just to see whether anyone gets it right away. If you do, I'll be very impressed. We can't write 5.08 less than mu less than 5.72 equals 0.6 because mu is a fixed but unknown parameter. Right, so the subtlety I'm getting at is that although we don't know what mu is, we're assuming that out there in nature there's an underlying population, an underlying distribution, which does have a well-defined and constant value of mu. So we have no business going just kind of changing it and thinking of it as a random variable. It's a constant unknown parameter. So we go and measure a value of x bar for our one data set that we've obtained, and therefore on the basis of that, only one of these statements is true. Which of the following statements is true? Is it that that probability isn't equal to zero? Anyone want to venture guesses for A, for B, for C, and for D? It's actually D. Now, it's very tempting to think it might be C, because of course I've been banging on about the fact that probabilities lie between 0 and 1. But it was a bit sneaky because I've put less than signs rather than less than or equal. In this instance, it's got to be D, and let me explain why. Mu is a fixed but unknown parameter. So we've gone out and we've observed one data set, we've got a sample mean, and we've worked out on that basis these values that correspond to the 68% limits, 5.08 and 5.72. Mu either lies between those values or it doesn't. Trouble is, we don't know, but that's just the way it is. It either does or it doesn't. If it does lie between those values, then the probability of that statement being true is 1. And if it doesn't lie between those values, I'm afraid the probability is zero. The trouble is, we don't know which. So by constructing the confidence interval, what you're doing is not really making a statement about the one sample you've observed. What you're doing is making a statement about what would happen if you repeated your observation a large number of times. Again, it's the old frequentist issue of repeating observations multiple times. Let me try and demonstrate it a bit further. As I've just said, I've written here again, mu is a fixed although unknown parameter that either belongs to that interval or it doesn't. So that's why D was the correct answer. So the statement at the top equals 0.68. The subtlety here is that I've written X bar as a capital. Now, I didn't want to get bogged down in boring notation, but to a statistician, the X bar being a capital means you're still thinking of it as a random variable. It's something that can have lots of different values. When I wrote X bar as a small X bar, that's because I was talking about the one sample I had gone and observed. So it's now got a fixed value. I can't change it anymore. So the statement at the top is fine because X bar as a capital is a random variable that can take on lots of different values drawn from its distribution. So here's an example of 20 realizations of the 68% confidence interval that I've generated from fake data drawn from a normal with a true value of 5. Okay, so what you see is that sometimes the confidence region overlaps the true value and sometimes it doesn't. And what you find is that about 68% of the time the confidence region overlaps the true value. So that's what you really mean when you talk about a 68% confidence region in frequentist probability. I'm afraid it still means it's eminently possible that the true value lies outside the region altogether. Whereas with a Bayesian credible region, what you're saying is I am 68% sure, 68% confident, that the true value does lie within this region. You're just dealing with the one data set you did obtain rather than imagining all of these other data sets that you didn't. It's a very subtle point, and in many practical situations you kind of get the same answer via the Bayesian or the frequentist, but the philosophy is different. And in particle physics in particular, there's some very sophisticated methods being developed called Feldman-Cousins methods, which try and get round some of these issues to do with coverage, as it's called. The coverage being the fraction, the number of times that the confidence region covers the true value. Now, I haven't included material about Feldman-Cousins in here. You know, it's a little bit kind of specialised, but I've certainly got some good references to it. Those who are working in that field will probably get exposed to it anyway. Bob Cousins, who was one of the kind of godfathers of that stuff, he was at a conference I attended in the summer of 2009, which was an attempt to get sort of Bayesian and frequentist people together and talking to each other, and it was actually very successful. But I still left that meeting thoroughly convinced that the Bayesian approach to credible regions was a lot more intuitive and straightforward than the frequentist one. But, you know, other people would take a very different view. I'm afraid that's just the way it is, that you've just got to accept that there are different ways to analyse the data. But like, what I wanted to lead with the whole Simon Singh illustration, and then leading on to my Seyfert example, to emphasise that provided the data are good enough, it really won't matter. The trouble is, a lot of the time we're dealing with data that isn't that good, so you do have to argue about whether you should do frequentist or Bayesian, or you do have to argue about choice of prior. Here's just another illustration of the same thing. This is 50 realizations of a 95% confidence interval, and you can see that two of them lie outside, which is kind of what you'd expect, so it's got the right coverage. But, you know, if you did another 50, you might find that maybe that time 3 or 4 of them lie outside. It's just an inherent feature of the procedure. I haven't got this loaded up, but there's an illustration I'll put on my super. There's a series of Math World illustrations that just require the Wolfram Mathematica player. You don't need the proprietary software, which just is a little applet that lets you muck around with this. You can see how the coverage is related to this process I've been describing. Okay. So the frequentist construction, it's all very rigorously thought through and very carefully applied, but from my point of view, I just don't think it's as straightforward and intuitive as the Bayesian credible interval approach. And certainly that's something that much of my community are now recognising. Also, just a much more mundane point, but just one to make, is that the credible interval isn't unique. If we're talking about a 95% interval, we could of course take 1% from one side and 4 from the other, or 5% from one side and nothing from the other, but you know, that's again somewhat a subjective choice. However, what you can do is you can define the shortest confidence interval and you can adopt that as your interval of choice. Okay, so let's say time is marching on. We haven't got too long to go. I appreciate that it's a lot of quite heavy-duty material to be thrown at you in a relatively short time. But what I'm hoping you're getting from all of this, above all, is that there's maybe a bit more to data analysis than you had previously thought, that there are subtleties and issues that even if it's somebody else's problem to think about them, it's important that somebody does. Because it isn't simply the case that you can just go to textbooks and apply a recipe and all is well. Fortunately, however, in many problems, you can do that. But in many of the interesting problems that are sort of at the cutting edge of physics nowadays, because you're dealing with small data sets or maybe even large data sets, but very noisy ones, then there are these very careful issues that need to be thought through. So I just want to sort of wrap up today with a couple of examples of practical situations for this sort of thing has been done. Again, I'm going to go through them fairly briskly because I don't want to get bogged down in details, but it's just to open your eyes to some of the ways in which these methods are being applied now. So here's one that could be, for example, relevant to getting the location of a star in the sky, the rate of earthquakes, or things like the rate of LHC interactions or dark matter particle candidates. And it's all to do with using a Poisson distribution. So I've adopted the same notation as Phil Gregory's section 14, which means it's just ever so slightly different from the notation I used before. All that he does differently is he introduces a time, capital T, which is the duration of your observation. So that could be 1 second, 1 year, or indeed if it's a spatial variation, then it could be an area on the sky. So, in a Bayesian framework, what you want to do is take your likelihood, which is a Poisson, and you say to yourself, okay, I make a single measurement of n events, and from Bayes' theorem, what I want to do is make an inference on what the rate is, r. So r is our parameter, and we want to kind of get a posterior for r based on the observations we obtained. So Bayes' theorem just lets us do that. What should we choose as our prior? Now, tomorrow, we'll introduce something called the Jeffreys prior, and I'll talk about what the physics motivation for a Jeffreys prior is. Quite profound. It's to do with maximum entropy, as I mentioned earlier. And I'll talk about different situations and what the priors ought to be. Actually, in the case of Gregory's example, he just takes a uniform prior for R, and that will do us for the moment, because that's really not the main thing I want to illustrate today. But if you want to read more about it, then it's all there in his book. So you plug in your prior, and essentially what you're getting is an expression for the posterior for R based on the data that you've observed. So the posterior approximates to this thing here. Again, it's just a bit of algebra, so it's much easier to look at a picture. There is a picture coming up, honest. So you can work out modes, medians, means, sigmas, and so on from that function. And here's kind of how it looks. So if you observe nothing, you know, in other words, you observe for a certain amount of time, but you don't detect anything, n equals zero, the number of detections is zero, then your posterior for the rate, r, becomes very strongly peaked at zero. So it's just, again, common sense. It's saying that If I didn't see anything, then the chances are there's nothing there. If you made one detection, then of course the rate, the posterior for the rate, starts to diverge away from zero. It's got a peak at a non-zero value. So this is just a way of taking your data and then turning it into an inference about the parameter. And then the last two examples, well, this is just adopting a different prior. So it's very similar to the example I showed you earlier, the one that I had worked through for the Seyferts, that as the number of counts increases, then the sensitivity to the prior also becomes much, much less important. I just want to extend it a little bit though, and again this is a complication that does require some algebra that again I'm just going to skate over, I'm afraid, because there isn't really time. But it's to let you see that sometimes, you know, as an undergraduate you've had all sorts of courses that maybe have tackled problems that are idealised. It's so you can set exam questions on them, let's face it, that's the main reason. So that you can gain insight into the problem without overcomplicating it with lots of extra baggage. I'm afraid those days are over. If you want to tackle real data, real models, real problems, then sometimes you can't ignore complications. And an obvious one in this context is that you might be looking for a signal, but there's also a background. It doesn't really matter what that is. I'm thinking here of things like particle physics experiments, but it equally could apply in other areas too. So let's suppose that the background rate is known from prior experience, but that the signal rate isn't known. So there's a way to formulate all that. So I've worked through a bit of the algebra, just sketched it out. So it goes on. I wanted to give you a concrete example to kind of wrap up today with. And the first of them was this dark matter experimental result, the one that was reported quite widely in the BBC in December 2009. So basically what they got, just translated into the terminology of this example, was two detections, like two possible candidate particles, and an event rate of background events of 0.8 in the appropriate units. So here's the interesting thing. Big splash in the media, like I said, you know, I'm not saying they're any better or worse than lots of other scientists. Astronomers do this kind of thing all the time as well, because the BBC and other media outlets always love putting nice pictures of galaxies and so on, so we're all guilty of that. But here's the paper. And I mean, it's a good paper. Again, I'm not trying to not the authors, you know, because we all do this sort of thing. But if you look at the wording, actually it's not on that page, I think it's maybe in the next one. Yeah, no, I'm sorry, it is there. It's just hard to find on the screen. We observe two events in the signal region. Based on our background estimate, the probability of observing two or more background events is 23%. So that's what they put in the abstract of the paper. Now, I'm not making a judgment on the kind of particle physics aspects of this here. I'm not really in a position to judge. For all I can judge, they seem to have done a perfectly good job. I'm just looking at the statistics and how one interprets the numbers that come out of the statistical analysis. So here's the key. The predicted event rate, assuming no signal, looks like this. Now, what you're saying is that the predicted event rate, if there really isn't any signal, it peaks at zero. So the probability of observing two or more background events, even if there's no like foreground signal, is about 20%, which is awfully close to the 23% that they got. And moreover, the posterior PDF for the signal rate, yes, the posterior does peak away from zero, but there's a 15% probability that the signal rate is actually zero. 15% isn't that much less than 23, but they tell you about the 23 in the abstract and not about the 15. Now, as I say, I'm not saying that I would have done it any differently. We're all human. They're wanting to talk up the positive aspects of their analysis, but it's just a good way of illustrating how data analysis isn't quite as objective as you might think. The methods are, but how you interpret the results is, I'm afraid, rather subjective. It depends on whether you're trying to reinforce your model or reinforce someone else's. And, you know, this is no different from countless examples you can find. I mean, if you look at the paper in more detail, you see that some of these issues are indeed teased out. But what they chose to put in the abstract was to emphasise the possibility that this was a positive detection. In fact, the evidence for it is rather weak. So it's just a matter of exercising some caution when you interpret these sorts of things, and maybe applying the same caution if you're doing these analyses for yourself. As I said, you know, that's what it says. The probability of observing two or more background events is 23%. The probability of observing zero is 15%, which isn't so much less. So anyways, just to wrap things up, this one further example, I'm just going to skate through this very quickly, but it's just to open your eyes to some of the things that lie ahead tomorrow. So we've talked a great deal about model fitting and parameter estimation and all these kind of things. Let's look at one sort of example where a physicist might have quite a thorny problem to tackle. Suppose you've got spectral lines, which are sort of Gaussian in shape. It could be an astrophysics type problem, it could be laboratory physics, it could be photonics, it could be a number of different fields. And what you want to do is to fit the amplitudes of those spectral lines, so that's like the height of the Gaussian. And you assume that the other parameters are known. Well, basically what this is about is demonstrating that if you've got observed data, which actually looks kind of noisy, doesn't it? The parameter to be fitted is just the height of that Gaussian, and you're assuming that you know its horizontal position exactly, so you kind of know which channel to expect to see the signal in. Well, the posterior is a bit sensitive to the choice of prior, so that just echoes some of the things we said earlier today, that the price you pay for doing things in a Bayesian framework is that you've got the chance to include prior information, but you've got to make sure you do it right. So what's the right choice to use? Well, we don't really know. And here's where there's some sensitivity, but again, it was pretty noisy data, so maybe we shouldn't be too surprised. The prior dependence is less strong for a stronger signal. So now, instead of the data on the left and the top, you've got a much stronger signal at channel 40, and sure enough, the sensitivity to the choice of prior is much weaker. Again, tomorrow we'll look in more detail at what I mean by a uniform and a Jeffries prior, but they're quite different, and yet it doesn't really matter because the data were good enough. What if the frequency is also unknown? So in other words, you don't know which signal bin, which channel it's going to belong to. So you can compute the marginal posterior for the channel number, but stands to reason there's now a bit more flexibility in your problem, so maybe you're not going to define things quite so well. So in other words, there's a possible signal at bin 40 or thereabouts, which is the one that was really there before, but the data is now maybe arguing that there's weak evidence for another signal in lower channels, possible lines at 20 and 10. So if you allow the channel number to be a free parameter, then that changes significantly the posterior for the amplitude. So, you know, again, it's not surprising. If you don't even know how many lines there are in your data, it's clearly going to have an effect on how strong the lines you fit are. Should you be fitting only one line? Maybe it would be a better idea to allow the number of lines that you fit also to be a free parameter. We'll look at how you might do that tomorrow. So, we've covered a lot of ground today. I hope I haven't left you all reeling with all this stuff I've been throwing at you. But let's just try and couple more slides, just wrap things up. If it boils down to a question of Bayesian versus frequentist, who is right? Well, here's how I would kind of respond to that. I would say that, first of all, if you adopt a uniform prior, then maximising the posterior is equivalent to maximising the likelihood, which is a fancy way of saying that the Bayesian and frequentist methods will really give you the same answer. So that might look like a potential resolution to conflict, because you say, okay, we'll just adopt uniform priors. But maybe the uniform prior isn't the right thing to adopt. Again, we'll explore that tomorrow. Which means, if you're a real hardline evangelistic Bayesian, you would say that by not adopting a uniform prior, you're needlessly throwing away information that you ought to be including. So instead of the more conciliatory approach that I normally take and say, well, you know, both methods have their place, you just have to be careful and hope that your data are good enough that it's not too important, the evangelistic Bayesians would say that the frequentists are just plain wrong by not including information about the prior. The fundamentalist views along those lines can be found really on both sides, and I've put on my super some references, and just to let you see the kind of titles involved, Objections to Bayesian Statistics by Andrew Gelman, which, to give him credit, he's actually a Bayesian himself, but he was trying to be very even-handed about it. And this was from a conference a couple of years ago. I know a lot of the people that went to it, although I couldn't go myself. And then this is John Skilling, his reply, this physicist's view of Gelman's Bayes. So just to bring out a couple of the points. You figure anyone that resorts to using capitals, because maybe he's on a hiding to nothing, but he said, the discussions lack any serious account of why we must use Bayes, or of how I think we should use Bayes. Readers would think there was a choice. There isn't. Here, in complimentary response to Andrew's wonderfully successful provocation, is my own polemical rant on the subject. So, you know, we're all grown-ups now, you've left your undergraduate days behind, you've just got to accept that there are some things that scientists don't agree about, and your task is to try and make the best judgments you can by, you know, talking to people and trying to see what their arguments are. So I think, really, again, I just echo what Phil Gregory says, it's important to understand both approaches, and above all, to think carefully about their applicability to your particular problem. The one thing you mustn't do is just blindly apply somebody else's method without thinking about whether it actually works.